In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Mel Kemp on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine. Shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
And now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. Ed Corcoran has the night off, but he'll be back next month with more of his fabulous collection of old-time radio. A couple of years ago, here on the Golden Age of Radio, we featured the music of Glenn Miller and his famous Chesterfield radio program, Moonlight Serenade. The program ended as Glenn entered the Army in 1942 with plans to take his music to the troops overseas. Well, that left much more of the story to be told. Tonight, here is the rest of that story. The rain had been falling incessantly for 3 days now, and it was foggy and cold. Major Glenn Miller was growing impatient. He was anxious to move his Air Force band, all 62 members, from England to Paris. But details had to be worked out, not the least of which was finding accommodations for his men. Then, on Friday, December 15, 1944, word came through that the trip was on, even though the weather was still foul. The plane was a single-engine, nine-seater C-64 Norseman. Its pilot, Flight Officer Johnny Morgan, was considered an exceptionally able flyer. The hard rain had now leveled off to a steady drizzle. The ceiling was not more than 200 feet, and it was cold, the temperature only 34 degrees. How far from home all of these young men were. And for Glenn, drenched from a steady downpour, standing on a lonely runway in Bedford, England. How far removed he was from those exciting, glamorous days that had brought him the applause and adoration of a nation. Some 6 years earlier, on a crowded railroad station platform in New York City, a 17-year-old high school student from Hoosick Falls clutched his suitcase and followed the other passengers as they made their way to the waiting room. Once inside the cavernous station, his pace quickened as he headed toward the exit looking for a taxi. His destination, the New Yorker Hotel. The young man's name was Ray Eberly.
I came down to see my brother Bob in New York and Jimmy Dorsey's orchestra, and Glenn Miller was in the room at the time, and I happened to walk past a table where Glenn was sitting, and he was talking with Jimmy Dorsey's manager. At the same time, my brother Bob was up on the stage singing, and Glenn did a double take. He said, "I said I'm only drinking coffee here." He said, "So I know that it's not Bob." He said, "But it sure looks like him." So it was explained to him that I was Bob's kid brother, and I was introduced to Glenn Miller, and I didn't know who Glenn Miller, and nobody else really did. The guy was an arranger and a fair trombone player, and he said, "I'm going to start rehearsing an orchestra. Would you like to come up and sing a couple tunes at rehearsal?" So I said, "Well, I have to call my father." He said, "All right." So I did, and my father said, "Well," he said, "if that's what you'd like to do, go ahead. How could I turn it down? $35 a week." So I did then, and I joined the band then. And I'm still a dummy. I didn't ever make up the 6 months in school.
Ray Eberly sings Careless.
Thank you.
Within a short time, thanks to those late-night band remote broadcasts, Ray's name and voice had become very familiar to a nation hungry for this new music. Those nascent sounds of the Glenn Miller Orchestra would soon capture the hearts of America's youth. The nation was still feeling the effects of the Great Depression a decade earlier, but the excitement of the big bands, especially Glenn Miller, offered an escape from those worldly cares. Couples on the dance floor could swoon in close embrace as Ray Eberle caressed the microphone, or do the jitterbug when the band broke loose. Most people across America, however, enjoyed the music in their living rooms, or if they had a table radio, in their bedrooms, as the magic drifted in from romantic and faraway places, like Frank Daly's Meadowbrook in exotic New Jersey.
Thank you. and gentlemen, we come to the conclusion of this first broadcast of Glenn Miller and his music on his return engagement to Frank Dilley's Meadowbrook, New Jersey's popular rendezvous for diners, dancers, and lovers of America's finest dance music. Glenn Miller and his orchestra playing for you tonight.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
As the band's popularity increased, record sales zoomed skyward. Chesterfield agreed to sponsor the program Moonlight Serenade, featuring Glenn Miller every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday on the Columbia Broadcasting System. Hollywood was aware that big band stage shows would draw large audiences to their theaters, even if the movies were lousy. So they reasoned, let's put big bands in our lousy movies and really draw a crowd. Glenn would have none of it, unless the movie had a good script that included the band as an integral part of the story. The result was Sun Valley Serenade.
Let's go for a ride. Get your favorite one to sit by your side. Cuddle up in a sleigh. Giddy up, Nellie Gray, and away we go. While you listen to the sleigh bells ring, yodeling to your baby.
You'll feel nice and warm, no matter how cold it may be.
Take a look at little Jack and Jill. They ski down a hill. That's a snowplow turn. And look, there's a spill on a hill. When you're down, it's a thrill to go up again. Everybody ought to learn to ski, for that is how we first met.
We were the Jack and Jill and came down a hill. When I looked at you, my heart took a spill on a hill. It's a thrill that I can't forget.
It happened in Sun Valley.
It was on the 20th Century lot, as filming got underway, that Paula Kelly joined the band.
That was a very thrilling time for me. I didn't expect to sing anymore. As a matter of fact, I had sung with Al Donahue's orchestra, and before that, Dix DeBeale and a few other bands, but I just started my family at that point. And I replaced Marion Hutton, as a matter of fact, who had just had her first child, and I just had mine. And so I joined the Miller Band in 1941, and that was one of the first things that I did, and I was terrified.
Unfortunately, we didn't see Paula Kelly at the microphone in that picture. The part of the vocalist was played by Lynn Barry. And as Paula recalls, someone other than she did the singing.
What was her name? Pat Friday. I was in Sun Valley Serenade, though. I was a dark-haired, long-haired gal sitting in the ski sweater, and I was knitting, and we sang Chattanooga Choo Choo, and I looked up.
Hi there, Tex, what you say?
Step aside, partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo-choo?
Yes, yes,
track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga choo-choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania Station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shovel a load of coal in, gotta keep it rolling.
Woo woo, Chattanooga, there you are.
There's gonna be a certain party at the station.
Satin and lace.
I used to call Funny Face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never roam.
So Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga, Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga choo-choo.
The picture, which starred John Payne and Sonia Henie, along with Milton Berle, Dorothy Dandridge, Joan Davis, and the Nicholas Brothers, was very successful, in large part because it reflected the mood of the country just prior to World War II.
It was a romantic time, and people considered each other, and I don't know, there was a lot more thoughtfulness, a lot more love, I think, and I think people are starting to get back to that.
And did that feeling of affection and concern extend to the members of the band as well?
Oh, I thought the group was marvelous. The boys, it was like a family. Everybody got along great. They had their differences, and they'd make up, and it was just like one big family. Actually, it sounds trite, but it was true.
Goodbye.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
By now, Glenn had reached the pinnacle of success. He was grossing as much as $73,000 a week at the New York Paramount. Chesterfield renewed his radio show, and he won the make-believe ballroom poll on New York radio station WNEW, conducted by popular and influential disc jockey Martin Block. But the war was making him more and more restless. Then on February 15, 1942, Glenn registered for the draft with local board number 7 in Bergen County, New Jersey. Although he was too old to be drafted, he nevertheless decided he was going to war.
Left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
On October 7th, 1942, Alton Glenn Miller was inducted into the Army. His goal? To build a popular music band that would be relevant to young recruits and help to build morale for the troops overseas. But first, he had to go through officers' training school at Fort Meade, Maryland. After months of frustration and red tape, he was finally appointed Director of Bands Training for the Army Air Force's Technical Training Command. At last, he was in a position to begin assembling some of the best musicians in the country to star in that super band he wanted so much. One such musician was ace drummer and bandleader Ray McKinley, who, with trombonist Will Bradley a couple of years earlier, had set teenage America on fire with such hits as Celery Stalks at Midnight and Beat Me Daddy 8 to the Bar. Now he, too, was determined to become involved in the war effort.
I had my own band, and we had enlisted in the Marines as a unit, or we wanted to enlist in the Marines out on the West Coast, and we had some ratings all set up and this and that and the other thing, and the Marine Bureau of Appropriations and Policy, I think it was called, kept delaying all this because, after all, they were fighting a war at that time on Guadalcanal and places like that. And this kept being delayed, and then all of a sudden we were up at the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco, and about 8 of us got our draft notices in the same 3 or 4 days, and that was the end of that. That's when I got a hold of Glenn, and I said, I'm tagged, and this other thing's not going to work out, so what do I do? And he said, send me your serial number as soon as you go in and I'll pick you up.
By now, Glenn was at Yale University in New Haven, where Ray joined him.
That's right. We were stationed there from sometime in March 43 until we went overseas in June, about 2 weeks after D-Day, June 44.
Glenn and his music had been off the radio now for the better part of a year, and he longed to get back on. He wanted America to hear the new band and to entice volunteers to join the Air Force's Technical Training Command. In mid-1943, he got his wish.
I sustain the wings.
He tested the program with a few broadcasts from Yale University in New Haven that were carried by WEEI Boston. By mid-July, the show was ready for the full CBS network.
I sustain the wings. The Army Air Forces present the Band of the Training Command under the direction of Captain Glenn Miller. And now, Captain Glenn Miller.
Good evening, everybody. Speaking for the crew chief, Sergeants Brad Crawford, Mel Powell, Ray McKinley, Johnny Desmond, Lieutenant Don Briggs, and the gang, welcome to another program of I Sustain the Wings. In the music department, tonight's curtain lifter upper is Here We Go Again.
The show featured the full orchestra that had been assembled in New Haven. And what a band it was.
Well, instead of five reeds, we had six. Instead of four trumpets, we had five. We had four trombones when Glenn wasn't playing, which he didn't do very often. We had one French horn. We had two good singers, plus a vocal group called the Crew Chiefs. We had about 21 strings. And of course, piano, guitar, bass, and drums. All in all, it added up to 45, 6, 7, 8 men, depending on who was sick. And in addition to that, we had arrangers, copyists, and of course the fellows to do various kinds of clerical work. The whole organization went to about 50, 55 men, and we had our own table of organization, as you have to have in the Army, you know, with two master sergeants, four tech sergeants, and a whole bunch of staff sergeants, and then the buck sergeants, and then the corporals, and then the PFCs and so forth, and we had all that. We were a regular Army organization in that particular clerical sense.
After about 8 weeks, the show switched from CBS to NBC, where it remained for the next 11 months.
Music makes the miles fly faster, and here's a song that's flying a lot of them. the alma mater tune for the lads doing the training and the fighting the Air Force way.
Again, Glenn was restless. Doing the radio show and playing for GIs in this country simply wasn't enough.
Glenn always wanted to go overseas, which he finally was able to do and took the whole outfit over there.
And so in early June 1944, the radio series came to a close.
Captain Miller saying so long for the band of the training command, Sergeants Brad Crawford, Mel Powell, Ray McKinley, Johnny Desmond, the crew chiefs, and Lieutenant Don Briggs. Keep those V-mail letters flying to the boys overseas. Mail from home is number one on their hit parade. You can make your boys' day bright by writing that letter tonight. I Sustain the Wings is a presentation of the Army Air Force's Training Command and came to you from New York City.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
I remember on D-Day, June 6th, we were in New Haven getting paid that day, all that money they gave us in those days. It was only about 2 weeks after that that we got the word we were going to go over. And we went over and landed in Scotland. Glenn came up. He had flown over. He's the only one that did. And Paul Dudley flew over with him. He was in the organization. And he came up and got us. We went down to London just in time to catch the buzz bombs. And we were only in London about a week. Now, on our first day off, the boys wanted to go see London, you see, because up to that time we'd been performing various duties And Glenn said, no, sir, we're not going to have a day off. We're not going to do any nonsense like that with these bombs busting all. We happened to be right in the alleyway to the big power plant there in London, which the Germans were trying to hit with their buzz bombs. I don't think they ever did. But anyway, we had some pretty close calls. So he made us get out of there on Sunday morning. On the following morning, on Monday morning, which if you can imagine what would have happened had we persuaded him to let us have our day off. Sure enough, one of those buzz bombs hit right there where we were quartered and blew up the whole block. And so we were pretty lucky, and thanks to Glenn, we got out of that. Went up to Bedford, which was about 50, 60 miles north, mostly north, a little town where the BBC had used some makeshift studios during the Blitz in London. And we went up there and got quartered there, and we did all our broadcasting from there and our recording from there. And then we flew out of there to play concerts all over the island until we finally went over to the continent.
With the frenetic schedule facing Glenn and the band, no records were being cut, not even V-discs. And yet the band was recording.
Recording over there was always done as radio programs to be used later, as regular radio shows, you know.
And that wasn't always easy. The wartime acetate discs the BBC was using were often faulty, placing an added burden on the musicians. Just when they thought they had a finished program, the engineer would call and say that they had to do it all over again from the top. Those radio shows for the BBC and the American Expeditionary Forces Network were beamed to the thousands and thousands of American fighting forces on the continent. Broadcasting from England was not good enough for Glenn. He wanted his band and his music to be where the fighting was, in the smoke and rubble of Europe. Don Haynes, Glenn's executive officer and close friend, adjusted his trench coat to prevent the rain from going down the back of his neck. Glenn was determined to fly to Paris to make preparations for the band. The sky was overcast and the visibility so poor that when pilot Johnny Morgan first approached the field from a base 100 miles to the north, he missed it completely and had to circle around and try again. Now he was on the ground, and Haynes threw Glenn's B-4 bag through the open cabin door. Unfortunately, no radio communication would be permitted that day because the Battle of the Bulge was just getting underway. Also, the plane had no de-icing equipment, which meant it would have to fly below the weather, close to the surface of the choppy English Channel. As Miller climbed aboard the craft, Don Haynes waved goodbye. "Happy landings and good luck. I'll see you in Paris tomorrow," he said. Glenn replied, "Thanks, Hainsey. We may need it." As the plane took off, Haynes had no idea those would be the last words he'd ever say to Glenn Miller. Glenn's plane would never reach Paris. The holidays were just a few days away, and the band was already rehearsing its Christmas concert. Ray McKinley recalls how he heard the news about Glenn.
Well, we didn't know about it at first. They wouldn't let us off the ground for 2 days in pretty good airplanes. We knew that he had gone, we didn't know what kind of a plane he'd gone in. We found that out after. It wasn't much of a plane. And a little single-engine utility cargo C-64 Norseman. And we didn't know that he wasn't in Paris. Even when we got there and nobody met us, we still didn't know. We got there on the 18th, I think it was, 17th or 18th of December. He left on the 15th, I believe. And, of course, the Battle of the Bulge had just started, and Paris was a little panicky in the rear echelons. If you've read any of the war memoirs of the various guys, the rear was far more afraid of what was going to happen than the front was. And we were told not to unpack, but we did go to Paris and kind of scuffled around for ourselves there. Went down to this little hotel, the Olympiads, down in Montmartre. And it wasn't until about a week later, all the time they were looking for Glenn, you know, and hoping he'd show up. But when he didn't, when finally they reported to us, well, we felt pretty lousy. We felt like we lost our big brother because we knew what he had done by getting us out of London, if nothing else, you know.
Johnny Desmond sings, "I'll be home for Christmas. Maybe next Christmas, Johnny."
I'll be home for Christmas, though just in memory. Share the laughter of the folks I love as they trim the Christmas tree. I'll be home in spirit, my dreams will light the way. In my favorite chair, I'll be right there, even though I'm miles away. I'll join the Christmas carol singing like I used.
The band's final personal appearance took place in 1945 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., before a distinguished gathering headed by President Harry S. Truman and Generals Dwight D. Eisenhower and Hap Arnold. Following a moving tribute by radio star Eddie Cantor, the curtains parted and the band began playing Moonlight Serenade. Then, an amazing thing happened. President Truman, without hesitation, rose to his feet to lead the entire audience in a standing ovation for the orchestra. No other popular musician in the history of America had ever received this kind of honor. And suddenly, these musicians must have realized the magnitude of their contribution and the contributions of the man who had brought them all together. And perhaps that night they also realized that the music they were playing would never die, but continue to bring pleasure and enjoyment to millions of fans throughout the world. My thanks to Ray Eberle, Paula Kelly, and Ray McKinley for sharing their recollections of Glenn Miller with us tonight, and especially to George T. Simon, author of the new book, Glenn Miller, for his fabulous insight into the man who defined the big band era. And now, until next time, for Ed Corcoran, this is Dick Bertel. Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel was produced and edited by Bob Schirago. This is Bill Hansen speaking.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse-o white and rinse-o bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day.